From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good Monday afternoon to you. Welcome to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, FRC's Director of Partnerships, sitting in today for Tony Perkins, Washington Watch's host and president of FRC. Well, we are now into day 17, if you've been counting, and the government shutdown continues as President Trump and Congress still haven't reached an agreement and passed a funding bill. The end of the shutdown is pending on the inclusion of a $5.5 billion wall and whether or not Pelosi will blink. Here are the details and possible updates from Senator Marsha Blackburn from the great state of Tennessee, who is not only the new senator from Tennessee, but a newly minted member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, one of only two women to serve in that role. President Trump is also withdrawing an Obama-era policy after the release of a report by his Federal School Safety Commission that reveals the policy encouraged oversight and a lack of disciplinary action in public schools. Did it create an environment or possibly that enabled a tragic Parkland school shooting earlier in 2018? Well, we'll talk with Bill Marshall, the senior investigator at Judicial Watch, who was part of the investigation into what went wrong. Family Research Council and the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists have put together a new publication addressing the 10 biggest myths about abortion. Dr. Ingrid Squapp, a board member of APLOG, authored the new publication that will give us the details on these myths and how to answer them with truth. And lastly today, we'll be joined by Washington Watch's very own Tony Perkins, who just finished up a trip to Egypt with fellow commissioners on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. They joined Pope Tewodros and Coptic Christians for their Christmas Eve service just outside Cairo and the opening of their new cathedral, a project spearheaded by Egyptian President el-Sisi. We will hear all about the trip later into the program. So once again, we are back at day 17. Congress is waiting for Pelosi to indicate she might be willing to move and give us more than the $1 she has promised to give us for funding this package. Earlier today, President Trump just announced he will address the nation on the humanitarian and national security crisis on the southern border tomorrow evening. And the White House shared that Trump will also make a trip to the border later in the week. He will not sign a spending bill that does not include funding for the wall and border security. Pelosi has indicated they will not sign on to a plan that includes the same. So with us now to talk about this is our new senator from the state of Tennessee, Marsha Blackburn, who serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee, again, one of only two women to do so, and the first woman senator from the state of Tennessee. Welcome, Senator Blackburn.
Oh, it's so good to be with you. Thank you so much, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. So just Thursday, you were sworn in as the new senator from the state of Tennessee, but we are currently at an impasse. And while at the current standby, you can look as to what is going on in Congress, and you haven't yet been presented with anything on which to vote because there is a bit of a stonewall. Are the Dems playing a game of chicken with President Trump at the expense of government employees? Because it seems to us that that's the case.
What we see happening is the Democrats are saying no to the wall. And they don't want to negotiate as long as there is any conversation about securing the southern border. What is so interesting to me is that President Trump has said, look, here is an offer for the Dreamers. Let's deal with that. Let's deal with securing our southern border so that we end illegal entry of all types, gangs, traffickers, those that are coming into our country to do harm. Let's end illegal entry. And the Democrats are saying no to that. And I find it just amazing. I had someone at church yesterday ask me, they're very involved with dealing with trafficking victims, human trafficking, sex trafficking, labor trafficking. And it was astounding to them that the Democrats would say, we are not going to work to secure the border, and that they're going to leave it open for these gangs and traffickers to come back and forth and continue to practice slavery, 21st century slavery, that they're going to enable and still allow that drug trafficking to come across that border and not take steps to secure it. And that's what millions of Americans want to see. They want to see a secure border. They want the Border Patrol to have the resources that they need. They want to make certain that people come to our country, but come to our country legally. And they want immigration laws to be enforced. And what we have to realize is that as long as that border is not secured, it makes every state a border state. It makes every town a border town, because the influx of drugs, the influx of gangs, the influx of illegal aliens. My goodness, we have in Tennessee, in Knoxville, Tennessee, this weekend, a young man was killed in a head-on collision. And we are waiting for ICE to confirm the immigration status, but it is believed that the individual that hit him is in the country illegally. He had no driver's license. He had no insurance.
Wow. Which also goes to the question of how this impacts the citizens of your constituent state. And I know also that you've spoken about the fact that the fentanyl crisis, much of the fentanyl that is in the state of Tennessee is coming from Mexico through the borders, and the porous borders are doing nothing but contributing to a worse situation. In fact, this is a promise that you made when you were running for Senate, and you're no stranger to how government operates. So after 8 terms in Congress as the 7th Congressional District Representative from Tennessee, you have seen long battles transpire. How long do you think this standout will take place?
I think this could go on for quite some time, because even with an offer to address the situation for Dreamers on the table, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are refusing to come to the table and negotiate. So, you know, if you've got a Dreamer in your life, you ought to be very upset with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer right now, because they're the ones who are standing in the way of some kind of legal status for the Dreamers.
And thank you for helping to support that message, because I do believe there are a lot of people who watch the news and don't believe or don't understand that Trump has offered up DACA protections as part of this entire package. And so they believe that all the Dreamers are going to be left out in the cold if there is some kind of a consensus reached on border security. And that's a critically important message. Senator, I want to ask you now.
Exactly. You're right about that. And here's something else to realize, is that President Trump is asking for $5 billion. That is 0.1% of the federal budget. If you want to break it down further, you could say it's 0.1% of our foreign aid budget, the money that we give to other countries. It is $5 billion, 0.1% of the federal budget to carry out a command that we agreed to do in when we take our oath of office, which is to protect and defend.
Well, that ties very nicely into another question I think some people want your response on. Pelosi's made much noise about the fact that she considers a border wall immoral. How do you answer Pelosi's charge that a border wall is somehow immoral?
It is just bordering on ridiculous. Walls work. Go ask Israel. Walls work. And the wall is not immoral. What you have to do is turn around and say, okay, where is compassion in this entire situation? I feel tremendous compassion, and it is devastating every time I talk to an angel mom who has lost a child or lost a spouse or a sibling to a crime committed by someone in the country illegally. When you talk to Border Patrol families where one of the Border Patrol agents has been killed by someone trying to enter the country illegally, I feel you share in that sorrow with those families and with those individuals. And then you also worry. I have visited these reception centers where these children are, and we know that the coyotes go into these villages and they take these children and they promise them a better day. The parents think they're going to get to the United States and have a better career. And they don't realize that they are subjecting these children to rape, to a tragic journey. And that when they get here, they don't know the individuals that these children are going to be turned over to. I just, to me, that is just devastating when you look at the state of these individuals that are being trafficked into the United States. And I talk to people every day who are Democrat and Republican who say, we need to clean this immigration issue up. People need to come here legally. They need to abide by our laws. They need to go through the legal process. We need to end illegal entry into our country. And just as we heard from the sheriff in California after Captain Singh was murdered by an illegal alien, it is the sanctuary cities that are harboring and offering refuge to those illegally in the country who are exacerbating this issue. And we don't have sanctuary cities for anything else. And we punish individuals who are outside of the law. And so tightening up federal law and enforcing that law so that we end this practice of sanctuary cities for those that are running afoul of immigration law.
Thank you so much, Senator. We have run out of time. There are so many other questions we have for you. I do know for my own part and for those of the other females that I know who are interested in policy and politics, your appointment to the Senate Judiciary Committee is heartening. We are excited to see what you'll do. To contact Senator Blackburn's office, call the Senate switchboard 202-255-3121. And coming up next, President Trump's administration announced that the end of the Obama-era school disciplinary policy followed what happened in Broward County, Florida. But why? We'll talk with Judicial Watch's Bill Marshall next.
Do you feel out of touch with what's going on in our nation's capital? Do you want to make a difference? Now you can. Family Research Council's Stand Firm mobile app is a new tool that is bringing Christians across America together and advancing faith, family, and freedom. The unique features of the app allow you to contact your congressman on important issues with just a tap of the screen. Sign up to organize culture impact teams in churches across the country and share the latest legislative alerts with family and friends. You can also listen to Washington Watch Live with Tony Perkins or read the Daily Washington Update to stay engaged and informed on issues facing our country. Join now in building a network of activists as we stand firm together for His kingdom. Go to frc.org/app and download the Stand Firm app today. Again, that's frc.org/app.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener. Homemade meals now replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. I don't even know what a goji berry is. My church started offering free Wi-Fi and changed their name from First Baptist to Radiant Water Life something or other. They even started posting video sermons recorded on wood pallet backgrounds that sync directly to a Dropbox that I have yet to locate. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Put down your quill and contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet. Share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Read the Washington Update and listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. This thing's got it all, buddy boy. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, again in for Tony Perkins, and I am very excited to talk to our next guest, both because I am a mother with children in public education and because this may have been the quietest Obama-era scandal of his administration. 3 weeks ago, President Trump released a report by the Federal School Safety Commission that highlights the best ways to ensure school safety, a commission that was formed after the Parkland shooting in Florida last February and chaired by Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos. The report recommended the withdrawal of the Obama administration's Dear Colleague letter. Now, this is not the first time I know you listeners have heard the Dear Colleague letter vernacular, but this one, dating back to 2014, went to the issue of school discipline and has received extreme criticism from Republicans over the years until the recommended rescission. Joining us now is Bill Marshall, who is senior investigator at Judicial Watch. Bill, so excited to talk to you today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about the format of what originally the Dear Colleague letter was designed to prevent.
Right. Well, the Dear Colleague letter was sort of a combination of carrots and sticks by the Obama administration to reduce the so-called school-to-prison pipeline, which the Obama administration sort of had fixed in its mind that the essential premise of the whole program is really obscene, in my view, and it is that white teachers, as a group, across the country, are racist and target black children or children of color, blacks, Latinos, for discipline or for suspensions and expulsions, and don't do that with white children. I mean, it's really, really obscene, in my view. And they base that not on actual intent on the part of teachers, but on numbers. That is to say, the number of children that are being arrested in schools. Something like 70%, I believe, is the figure that I've seen of in-school arrests were of blacks and Latinos. And the implicit assumption was that these kids are not being arrested because of their behaviors, but because they're being targeted by white teachers. And that's really a disgusting and sort of odious bottom line for this program that the Obama administration had had enacted and that they had articulated in this Dear Colleague letter of January 8th, 2014, where they essentially threatened to prosecute school districts across the country or investigate them. This was a joint Department of Justice, Department of Education letter that was issued. They threatened to investigate them if their numbers if the racial breakdown of arrests and suspensions in the school districts reflected a higher proportion of students of color being disciplined, regardless of the activities that they were engaged in. So, and then on the other hand, what they did was they essentially offered money, grants, to the school districts to try to get them to buy into this concept, into this program to basically cut down on their arrests or in-school arrests and suspensions of students. From its very foundation, I think the policy was really pernicious. And President Trump and Secretary DeVos are really to be commended for rescinding this obscene policy. And folks like Max Eden and Paul Sperry at Real Clear Investigations, Andy Pollack, the father of Meadow Pollack, who tragically died at Parkland, in the Parkland High School in Florida on February 14th of 2018. They're all to be commended, everyone who's worked, as are you, Sarah, for the work you all have done on this topic.
Well, we're extremely interested to see now what the blowback is. We've seen some of the typical actors sort of voicing their criticism of the fact that this is a rollback of this disciplinary policy, but it really was a radical shift from disparate treatment to disparate impact. And they sort of followed Robert Runce, who was the superintendent of schools at the time, his sort of MO, which was, we will not arrest anyone. Now, Robert Runce, for those listeners who don't know, was sort of a protege of Arne Duncan, and this was his product, Arne Duncan, also the architect of the Common Core State Standard. So a lot of bad federal policies related to education. So let me ask you this quickly, because I've got about 2.5 minutes left here. I want to know how this directly implicates the Broward School Board, exactly what the timing was, and how potentially administrators may have had their hands tied by this disciplinary colleague letter.
Well, I think it absolutely did. I mean, the number of arrests that occurred in Broward County went down from like over 1,000 in school arrests in 2013, when the first collaborative agreement was signed by Broward County as part of this whole Promise program, to take kids to stop kids from being arrested and removed from classrooms, and instead putting them into healing circles and obstacle courses and self-esteem building exercises. So the arrest went from over 1,000, I think, in 2013 to 300 something the following year. So sure, it appeared that Robert Runce was doing this wonderful job, of reducing, of managing the district and reducing the number of kids that were being disciplined. But in reality, they were just brushing it all under the rug. So they weren't making, one of the lines in this Dear Colleague letter was Eric Holder saying, or I'm sorry, was was Education Secretary Arne Duncan saying, effective teaching and learning cannot take place unless students feel safe at school. And then, perversely, the way he's going to make students feel safe at school is by leaving the most criminal-minded or violent and disruptive students in the schools instead of removing them or having them removed through arrest and suspension. So this is sort of typical leftist thinking, where the world is kind of upside down and their solutions to these problems are almost exactly 180 degrees the opposite of what they should be.
Oh, Bill, we have so much more that we could talk about. We'll have to have you back for another segment. If you want more information on Bill or on Judicial Watch, go to judicialwatch.org. But coming up next, obstetrician gynecologist Dr. Ingrid Squab gives us a look at FRC's newly released publication, The Top 10 Myths About Abortion. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Do you feel out of touch with what's going on in our nation's capital? Do you want to make a difference? Now you can. Family Research Council's Stand Firm mobile app is a new tool that is bringing Christians across America together and advancing faith, family, and freedom. The unique features of the app allow you to contact your congressman on important issues with just a tap of the screen, sign up to organize culture impact teams in churches across the country, and share the latest legislative alerts with family and friends. You can also listen to Washington Watch Live with Tony Perkins, or read the daily Washington Update to stay engaged and informed on issues facing our country. Join now in building a network of activists as we stand firm together for His kingdom. Go to frc.org/app and download the Stand Firm app today. Again, that's frc.org/app.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Well, it will come as no surprise that the abortion debate is one of the most emotionally charged and controversial issues in the policy landscape today. It is literally a matter of life and death, which is why it is so important to cover some of the myths concerning abortion. FRC and the Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists have partnered together to shed light on some of these false arguments in their new publication, Top 10 Myths About Abortion. Leading up to Pro-Life Con on January 18th and the March for Life, FRC will be releasing a series of videos discussing each myth. But with us now is the author of this wonderful new publication and the voice of our upcoming video series, Dr. Ingrid Skop, a pro-life obstetrician who serves on APLOG's board. Welcome, Dr. Skop.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah.
Well, like all good questions, when there are numbers involved, I'm going to go right to the chase and ask you, what is the biggest number one myth about abortion?
Well, I think in a nutshell, the biggest number one myth is that it is good for women and that women need abortion.
Why are women under the mistaken impression that they need abortion? Why is there this willingness to accept the narrative that it is good for women without actually taking into consideration the consequences of abortion or post-abortive syndrome?
Well, understandably, abortion is something that people don't really want to think about. And so I think most of us tend not to give a lot of time to looking into the issue, to finding out what's really involved in the procedure. I would say that the pro-choice side has cornered the market on pleasant-sounding euphemisms. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think we really do need to be fighting back against, to call it women's health care, to call it women's choice. Most people hear that and they say, well, I don't walk in the shoes of a woman who's in a crisis pregnancy. So even though I may personally find it, unconscionable or whatever, I'm not going to say that that woman shouldn't have that option. So we all kind of walk around saying, well, I don't really know enough about this to weigh in on the subject. And that's why, as an obstetrician, I've been frustrated for a number of years because I feel like people don't really understand. They don't understand the risks that are involved in the procedure. They don't understand the consequences particularly the mental health consequences, the regret, the social, the family breakdown that follows abortion. And so that's why I wrote this little paper, to just shed some light on some of these common misconceptions.
You know, it's interesting, we're talking about post-abortion trauma and the mental health consequences, and yet Planned Parenthood in Iowa, Planned Parenthood of the Midwest, has launched a new series of feature billboards around the state asking people to speak their abortion. In other words, removing what might be perceived as the privacy or the stigma around it. And this is obviously in direct result. It's a direct result of the fetal heartbeat bill, which has passed, and the Iowa legislature saw what they were doing. They understood the need for a bill like this, but currently Planned Parenthood is suing, so it's on hold. But it strikes me as interesting that they are using the images of three different women talking about speaking their abortion as if it were something to be proud of. How do you answer a criticism from someone who might have had an abortion, who feels the shame about it and is being told, perhaps convincingly by Planned Parenthood, that they need to be very open about the fact that they've had an abortion and even proud about that fact?
Truthfully, I think in this area that Planned Parenthood is overplaying their hand. They are trying to normalize abortion. Their rhetoric says this is just another healthcare procedure. And the American people see past that. I mean, we, in the age of technology, of YouTube, of everybody seeing an ultrasound of somebody's baby posted on Facebook, America knows that this is not a blob of tissue. We know that it's a living human being. And although some women in crisis may feel this is the only option I have, and I would never want to give them additional guilt because they're going to have enough guilt because they know what they've done. They're never going to get, other than a few misguided Hollywood types, they're never going to get the general population of women to start bragging about their abortions. This is not anything that anybody would be proud of. They may feel it's necessary. They may feel that they had no other choice. But nobody really is going to be proud of this. I think it's interesting that even back 20 years ago with Bill Clinton, the rhetoric was abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. Well, it's legal. It's debatable how safe it is. Most of the studies that indicate that it's safe are actually produced by the abortion providers like Planned Parenthood, so we have to worry a little bit about the bias of those studies. It's no longer rare. And now we've come to the place where we say, well, we don't care if it's rare. We want it to be as common as women need it to be. And I just think that people are going to start pushing back against that. When you look at survey data, two-thirds of Americans don't want abortion to be legal after the first trimester. 80% of Americans don't want it to be legal after viability, and yet we've got laws
on the
books.
Dr. Scott, we're out of time. Thank you for your excellent paper. We look forward to dealing with you, talking with you more during Pro-Life Con and the March for Life. This has been Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry. Stick around. We'll talk with Tony Perkins from Egypt next.
The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener. Homemade meals now replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. I don't even know what a goji berry is. My church started offering free Wi-Fi and changed their name from First Baptist to Radiant Water Life something or other. They even started posting video sermons recorded on wood pallet backgrounds that sync directly to a Dropbox that I have yet to locate. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Put down your quill and contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet. Share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Read the Washington Update and listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. This thing's got it all, buddy boy. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener, replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet and share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to our other free resources, go to frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. This is Sarah Perry in for Tony Perkins, our president here at FRC. Last night, Coptic believers celebrated Christmas Eve for the first time in a brand new cathedral constructed by President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi just outside Cairo. Tony Perkins is one of the fellows on the commissioner of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. He joined their service last night and over his trip to Cairo, met with religious and governmental leaders, including Pope Tewodros and President al-Sisi. He was one of three who took the trip, Nadine Mesna and Johnny Moore as well. And at the invitation of Egyptian government and the Coptic Church, the delegation attended the opening of both their cathedral, which is now the largest in the Middle East, and the al-Fattah Ali Mosque, both in the new administrative capital east of Cairo. So Tony joins us now. Tony, welcome to your own Washington Watch. Great to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Thanks for filling in as I'm working my way back to the States. We've had a busy 4 or 5 days in Egypt and Cairo in particular, but it's been very instructive and very encouraging, actually, to be there last night for the Coptic Christians, as the Orthodox Christians celebrate Christmas based on the Gregorian calendar, which usually falls January the 7th. Today's Christmas for Orthodox Christians. It was a real treat to be in their cathedral. It's a massive cathedral, seats about 7,000 people, built in 18 months in the administrative capital, which is about, I think, roughly 40 to 50 miles outside of Cairo. It's quite a drive through the desert regions, kind of barren area, but there's a lot of security. Security's been very tight there, as there was one bomb that was discovered and detonated the day before. Unfortunately, the bomb tech was killed in that effort. But we broadcast from Cairo Thursday night last week. We didn't mention it for security reasons, but we were on the ground there in Cairo meeting with evangelical Protestant leaders. As you mentioned, we met with the Coptic Pope, spent about an hour and a half with him. I had a chance last night during the festivities to briefly speak with President Sisi. But Sarah, what's fascinating about this is the push by President Sisi to expand religious freedom and tolerance in a country that is 90% Muslim. And so he is making room for Christians and other religious minorities. And the building of these two elaborate centers of worship in the administrative capital, dedicated, inaugurated on the same day, speaks a lot, especially in a country where there's only like 10% of the population are religious minorities. So very encouraging to see the movements, the policies he's pushing forward to embrace greater religious understanding and tolerance. And again, we look at this, Sarah, from the through the kind of the perspective of the Middle East, not the Western view of religious freedom, but they are, I think, positioning themselves to, quite frankly, become an example to the rest of the Middle East.
Oh, how wonderful. Now, in your discussions with Pope Tewodros of Alexandria, who you mentioned was the head of the Coptic Church, what did he have to say? I'm curious about President El-Sisi's involvement in the construction of their new cathedral, because this isn't just the permission to worship. This is going above and beyond to actually construct the largest church in the Middle East for worshiping. I'm curious as to what he had to say.
Well, you got to keep it in context that we actually saw a number of the Coptic churches destroyed in the recent past, you know, when Muslim Brotherhood was in control. And even today in the outer regions, once you get outside the metropolitan areas, there's still a lot of problems in Egypt, in the smaller communities, certainly in the Sinai region, in the southern parts of the country. There's not a full appreciation for the rule of law in Egypt. All you have to do is drive down the street or ride in the car for 5 minutes and realize rule of law is out the window. Yeah. It's chaotic. But there's, even though these policies have been advanced that are supportive of, protective of religious liberty or freedom, worship, it's not respected at all levels. You still have some very negative influence in some of the local levels outside the metropolitan areas, but you also have cultural issues. And this is where the president is addressing the cultural issue. And this is what it's interesting. The evangelical leaders, Protestant leaders we spoke to, talked about education. The Pope himself talked about, when, you know, we were discussing the specifics of religious freedom, what other policies needed, it almost always came back to education, of educating in terms of respect and understanding of religious diversity. And so the president is doing that. And the symbolism was very strong last night when you had the inauguration of both of these centers of worship on equal footing. And again, we're looking at this from the Middle Eastern perspective, in a country where there's 90% Muslim, that a president is saying, we respect the right and we embrace them as our fellow Egyptians, those that have a different religious perspective. And I said, the religious leaders that we spoke to, and we spoke to quite a few, have a very positive view of President Sisi, and see a lot of these policies that we would not find fully embracing of religious freedom from a Western perspective. They see it as transitional and very positive from an Egyptian standpoint. I will say one other thing with the Pope. He took to my name because the first monk, it was from Egypt, Antonio, and so he was trying to recruit me for one of their monasteries. But in fact, about three or four times I saw him during the course of our stay, and he mentioned that. So, but I told him the application would be in the mail.
I was going to say, I bet that was a bit of a hard sell, but that's certainly a great sentiment, if nothing else. Has President El-Sisi talked about specific steps to create an overall environment of religious tolerance? And you mentioned the fact that El-Sisi is in a position to really create that, but there are, at the lower levels, less of a tolerance, and there continue to be these human rights violations that are taking place behind the scenes, out of the vision of government, where there is this wonderful concept. So how does he get that tolerance, that religious freedom, continually pushed out to the other individuals in the nation that is predominantly Muslim, as you said?
Well, one of the things that they're doing is a reform of the educational curriculum. And they've started basically with, how do you eat an elephant? Eat it one bite at a time. So what they're starting with is basically they started in kindergarten. They expand to the first grade next year, include the second grade after that. And so they're changing and modifying the curriculum to be more reflective of the vision of religious tolerance. And it was very evident last night in a pre-event that they did at a very elaborate hotel that's at the administrative capital, where they did a kind of a one-hour variety show with some of the prominent entertainers in Egypt, intermingled with video presentations, one of them being of children, young children talking that were some Catholic, some Christian, some Muslim, talking about their friendship and talking about how they play together, they work together. And it was very, very clear what the president and this administration is wanting to do. There is a lot of pushback. There's even some pushback within some of the Islamic centers of education. So the president taking a remarkable step forward. That's not to say, again, Egypt doesn't have problems and that there are not challenges there. But again, from the from a Middle Eastern perspective, and just looking at it through that paradigm, I do think that he's making tremendous strides forward. And we can, as an American government, as American Christians, encourage him in that. And I'm hoping that we'll see greater initiatives from the United States, from our government, from the Trump administration, which, quite frankly, I think is a big part of President Sisi moving in this direction, that we can help them move even further ahead.
Now, this is not your first time to meet with President El-Sisi, correct? You were there at the end of 2017. So within the span of one calendar year, what is one of the biggest differences that you've noted between both your visits?
Well, we did get a chance to meet with him this time and sit down and talk with him. It was just a very brief exchange I had at the event last night. But I think what I see is there is more church buildings are being authorized. Now, we would say that that's a problem, that they have to have a license to build a church. Actually, in talking with the Protestant evangelical leaders, they see that as a positive thing. It's the first time they actually recognize their churches, and they see this as a transitional step. And so this gives them legitimacy. And so some of these things that from, a Western perspective, we think, wow, this isn't very good. But in the context of what they've faced in modern time, this is a very positive development. So there is incremental strides, but I'll have to say the symbolism, the cultural implications of what took place last night were quite significant. And I think they were seen, I know they were seen not only in Egypt, but they were seen throughout the Middle East.
Now, your discussions between the Pope and between the president, did they spread to human rights violations as well? Was that considered? Because as we've discussed before, having a policy of religious freedom and religious tolerance is an excellent one. But at the ground level, if there are continuing human rights violations, that ought to be concerning. And it sounds like President El-Sisi is of a mind that he would be. And so were there any discussions specifically about human rights violations?
No, not in particular, not with the Pope. And again, we didn't really have a sit-down meeting with the president on this event. We did have discussions with other leaders, governmental leaders and others that we met with. And clearly there's some things there that need to be looked into. But, you know, I was there kind of wearing two hats. I was there as a part of an evangelical delegation and wearing a hat as a commissioner in some of these meetings. And so for the commission standpoint, we are very narrowly focused because our charge, our commission from the Congress is to look at religious liberty issues. And so that's kind of the area that we focus on. There's no question there are challenges and some problems in Egypt. And it's a much bigger issue than one president can solve in a short period of time. I go back to something I said earlier. One thing that's very evident is the rule of law is not strong. That's going to take time. A lot of this is educational. But the point that we see with religious liberty, and we've seen this, we've talked about it elsewhere, is that a country that embraces a vibrant understanding and definition of religious freedom, that leads to a greater respect of other human rights, leads to greater economic and social stability. So we see this as really at the tip of the spear of moving a country, a nation forward in the right direction that respects all people.
Mm. Something our own nation is currently struggling with, it would seem. So I think we would do well to keep an eye to what is happening in the Middle East and particularly in Egypt. My question to you, and this is our last question, all we have time for, we've got about 2 minutes left. I cannot imagine how wonderful it must have been to celebrate a Christmas Eve service in that new cathedral just outside Cairo, understanding how close you are to that nexus, that cradle of all of the stories and all of the truth we hold so dear in our own Bible. What was that like? And is there a moment that you can share with the listeners about that entire celebration?
It was special. Of course, it was in Arabic, and so it was. We were not able to keep up. We were able to read along with the passages, but not able to hear everything, understand everything that was being said. But to be there in that moment and understand the historical implications of what was taking place, and the fact that we're celebrating Christmas, where the angels declared to the shepherds peace, goodwill to men, that the elevation of that same message of peace, which we know as Christians comes through a relationship with God, our Creator, through Jesus Christ, that is being embraced and being recognized in the Middle East, right there in Egypt, and I believe, again, could become a model of religious tolerance, is quite encouraging.
Tony Perkins has been talking with us today. Tony is our president here at FRC, but he is also a commissioner on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and has had some spectacular opportunities to take place in meetings with these individual leaders all around the world, but specifically in the Middle East, where religious freedom has heretofore been truly a foreign concept, where Christians are in the minority. So, Tony, thank you so much for giving us an overview, and we'll continue to pray for your position on the commission and in all the good work that you're doing to expand the kingdom and to learn more about where Christians can be influential for the kingdom. This has been Washington Watch. Catch us back here tomorrow.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.